The topic we're going to be speaking about is a lawyer's role in a din Torah, streamlining the process. Now, if you'll just allow me for one moment, I would like to address one point that Rabbi Cohen spoke about, just a little bit of clarification. Someone wanted to know, why is it that the Beis Din does not have jurisdiction to impose a pshara or a compromise based on their perception of justice, and why is it that the judges do have that right? And there's really two points which I want to bring out. The first point, just briefly, the first point is that we know that in civil law versus criminal law, in order to come to a conclusion, the ruling has to be what they call beyond a reasonable doubt. And although there may be preponderance of evidence indicating the guilt of the party, that just doesn't, you can't conclude the case with that. Whereas, when you're dealing in a civil suit, the preponderance of evidence is sufficient in order to bring out the conclusion. In halacha, pure din, pure law, dictates that if you want to take money from one person and give it to somebody else, take money out of my pocket and give it to someone else, that requires beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't rely on the preponderance of evidence. That's why you need the parties to submit themselves to the jurisdiction of Beis Din for pshara, for a level, some level of settlement, and then with the preponderance of evidence, they're capable of extracting the money, in Rabbi Cohen's words, from one party and giving it to the other. The second reason is we happen to live in the United States of America, and we are not living under, and wherever you're going to go in this world today, we're in a fallen state. The world is in a fallen state. It used to be, indeed, it says in Shulchan Aruch, clearly in Siman Yud Beis, that if the Beis Din sees, according to their understanding, that it is correct and proper that George's money belongs to Robert, they have absolutely the obligation to extract the money from George to Robert, even though it's only based on preponderance of evidence. However, being that we do not, the civil courts, they have natural governmental given rights to adjudicate a dispute. Whereas the Beis Din in America and anywhere in the world, for that matter, only has these rights based on the fact you signed the arbitration agreement. And thereby, the arbitration agreement with the Beis Din only has jurisdiction to address the level of arbitration that you bestow upon, that the parties, the litigants, bestow upon the Beis Din. And therefore, if they're only mekabel din, technically for strict din, then Beis Din's hands are tied. Again, we heard Rabbi Cohen's explanation about the necessity and the moral imperative to allow the Beis Din to have that level of jurisdiction in order that the truth, what is commonly understood as fairness and justice, should prevail. Now, getting to our topic, there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers, which refers to lawyers. It says as follows, Yehuda ben Tabai Omer, a great rabbi, expressed, do not make yourselves like lawyers. So it would seem that the perception of lawyers, you shouldn't make yourself like them, like those lawyers over there, that there's some kind of evil creatures that are to be avoided. And if you look in Maimonides' dissertation, explanation on this Mishnah, he says, amongst other things, because you understand, God loves the truth, and the lawyers do not. And thereby, ultimately, if you're going to make yourself like a lawyer, you're going to end up doing things which are incorrect. On the other hand, we have, there was also a great commentator, his name was the Rajba, medieval commentator, and in the Tshuva, he writes that it's a great mitzvah to act as a lawyer and to help the parties present their cases. Why? Because God loves the truth. So everybody's claiming, you know, Hashem is on their side. The question is, what is, and there's no contradiction here, the question is when yes and when not. Hashem always loves the truth. God always loves the truth. The question is, what will bring out the truth and what will bring out the opposite? So the Torah says in Parshas Kedoshim, Lifnei Iver L'Siten Mechshol, which means, in front of a blind man, you may not put a stumbling block. A man walking down, he can't see, walking with a cane, you put something in front of him, and he trips over, he stumbles. In fact, the Torah even says that Arum Ashki Ivan B'derech, he should be cursed. He deserves to be cursed, the person who makes a blind man stumble. Now, thank God none of us in this room would even contemplate looking for a blind man, putting something in front of him, and having him stumble. That's just, you know, I think that's beyond the pale for many reasons. But Rashi explains this pasuk, and the Gemara explains the pasuk in two additional understandings. The first understanding that Rashi brings down, he says, Lifnei suma badavar, a person is blind in a certain matter. He doesn't see. Sometimes you look, and you can look at, I taught a class and I wrote something on the board, and I purposely wrote something that is well known that people will look at it and they won't see it. And I had one boy in the class read it, he read it, and he read it, the whole class is laughing because he couldn't see what was actually written on the board. So you could be blind, not only physically blind, but if you're unable to perceive what's there, that's also called a blind person. And Rashi says this teaches us that it's forbidden to give a bad advice. If somebody comes to you for advice, and they don't know, the reason they're asking advice, they don't know what's right and what's wrong, what they should be doing. And to give them bad advice, that's lifnei l'sitin michshol, you are making a blind man stumble. In addition, the Gemara tells us that if a person has a desire to transgress the laws of the Torah, whether this person is Jewish, the person is non-Jewish, and he wants to transgress what is incumbent upon him, a God-given law, and you enable him to do that, so you're also transgressing lifnei ivel l'sitin michshol. This person is a blind person, that means he's going to stumble only because of your input. So you're going to be transgressing on lifnei ivel l'sitin michshol. You should not cause a blind man to stumble. The man doesn't know better, and you're enabling him. That's also included, and it says, or mashki ivel b'derech, should be cursed the person who enables a man to stumble. Now, you're all lawyers, most of you, and you're all familiar with a client who comes to your law office and he presents you with his tale of woe, and you hear as he's telling it to you that he's in the wrong. Halachically he's wrong, legally he's wrong, morally he's wrong, and in any other sphere of existence he's wrong. The person is wrong, but he has a nice bank account and you would like to just a little bit deplete his and fill up yours. So, great. So you have a vested interest, shall we say, to encourage him to represent him. However, you're not supposed to put a stumbling block in front of a person who's going to transgress, who's going to stumble. So what's going to happen? What's going to happen is as follows. If he's wrong, assuming that he's wrong on all levels, and you help him win, he's victorious. You come into court, you come into Beis Din, as it were, and you present the case, and you're able to convince the judge or the dayan of the justice of your cause. So what you've just done is you've enabled a thief to steal money. Whether he's the defendant, whether he's the plaintiff, makes no difference. You're enabling a thief to steal money. The Gemara tells us, besides everything else, there's a fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says, like, let's say you know testimony for someone. Two people, we'll give George and Robert, again, they're in court, and we're in Beis Din, and you know testimony, and if you go to court, you're going to enable George to be victorious over Robert. And you know the testimony, and you don't go. And because of that, Robert wins the case. So even though clearly you're not in, shall we say, in earth laws, right? Beis Din couldn't make you pay because you just caused it. You caused damage by failing to testify. But the Talmud tells us, B'dinei Shamayim, in heaven, they're going to hold you culpable. You are responsible for the fact that George was victorious over Robert. So in our case, if you're going to defend or you're going to represent this client who you know is wrong and he's going to be victorious, the person who you helped stole money, that's nothing more, nothing less, I'm sorry for using such strong words, and in addition, you are held on a standard in heaven responsible for having caused this person to extract money from one person to the next. Sometimes you say, okay, fine. I'm not going to be so, you know, I'm not going to have a pitchfork with a tail. What I'm going to do is as follows. I'm going to call up the other party's lawyer, and instead of actually coming to court, I'm going to force a settlement. He made a settlement. They're big people. They're grown-ups. If they feel that I'm wrong, let them say so. They can defend the case. They don't have to settle with me. So now all I'm doing is I'm settling. I'm making some kind of pshara, some kind of settlement. We're talking out-of-court settlement in order to avoid the Bezdin process. In fact, what you're going to do, sometimes people do, they send off letters from the lawyer saying that we are going to represent our client to the full extent of the law. And the other party starts quivering, and they're thinking, oh, they start looking at the court costs are going to be exorbitant. And they say, what should we do here? Well, you know what? Let's just settle. So you go and you make a settlement, and they all sign in it, and everybody's happy. Everybody walks away, and everybody, no, you can't do that. The Truma Sadeshin says clearly, you're not allowed to do that. You cannot threaten people with lawsuits or any form any form of blackmail, as it were, because the person doesn't want to have to go through protracted legal proceedings. So because of that, you're going to go and you're going to get into a negotiated settlement, as it were. So again, you're helping somebody extract money that he's not entitled to. In fact, there's a Chuvas HaRajba who says as follows. The Rajba says, let's say there was a person, he owed money. His friend comes over to him, you owe me $100. He says, no, I don't. Do. Back, I do, I don't. You know what? I'll tell you what. I will pay you half of what you're claiming on the condition that you sign this paper. And this paper says, I hereby admit that the totality of the claim is only $50. It shall be considered paid in full, both in this world and in the world to come, in heaven and on earth. That's it. No more further discussion shall be made about this money, and end the discussion. So the Rajba says such a document is a worthless piece of paper. Why is it a worthless piece of paper? Because if I am moichel, if I forego a loan or forego a debt of any sort, simply because I'm under duress, and if I had no other choice but to forgive it, it's not considered forgiven, even if I signed my signature with 100 witnesses to the effect. He says, imagine, I go over to my friend, I rip his wallet away from him, and I'm telling you, I'll give you half the money back if you forgive me the other half. It's nothing. It's ludicrous. And therefore, the Rajba says, so even if you could actually extract from the other party a negotiated settlement based on the fact that you could put the other party through a lot of monetary and emotional pain, it doesn't really hold water. Now, let's say your client is correct. Your client is on the right. He's not wrong. But sometimes it happens that you're going to represent your client and he's going to lose. You hear from the way he's explaining you the case, it is very clear what happened. But you also hear very clearly that the evidence that your client will have is paltry. It's just insufficient evidence. Someone called me up. They said, I handed this other fellow a lot of money. He handed him hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he told him, I want you to buy into a partnership. And he said, sure, absolutely, you buy into the partnership. And let me go in the other room, and I'll get the documentation that we could sign. And then the guy came back, and he said, what do you want? So what do you mean? The papers. Papers? Why are you? He made a complete, like they say in Yivrach. He ran away with the money. He says, what do you mean? I just handed you the money. I don't know what you're talking about. Get out of my office. If you don't get out, I'm going to call the police. And he chased him out. So it was at least based on his presentation of the facts. Assume we could take him on his word. I mean, he had no reason to call me up otherwise. Tell me basically, he wanted me, I should go talk to the person and explain him that it would be really appropriate for him to return the money. And I said, I'm sure you're a very fine person. I don't know you from a hole in the wall. So I should call my neighbor and tell him that he's a thief. It's not going to go over so well. But no,
Don't tell him he did it. Tell him if he took the money, he should get. Okay. Now, but the point is that even if you assume that the person who came to you is correct and he's justified, but if the person has no evidence and you're going to represent him, so you're being you're giving him bad advice. Because he is going to be paying you real money, and he's going to be paying court fees, and at the end of the day, he's walking out with nothing. So what are you doing? You're just wasting his time and money for nothing. It's not. You're not getting anywhere. Even in the event that you believe that he will be victorious, he'll be successful in the case. But sometimes it happens that, you know, the operation was a success, but the patient died. Sometimes the court fees and the lawyer's fees and the tayanim fees are so exorbitant that at the end of the day, once you've made your recovery, as it were, you end up with, it just wasn't worth it, it wasn't worth the effort. It would have made much more sense for them to make a pshara of sort. So the person, he had a $500,000 claim against one of his partners, and he hired one of the hotshot tayanim, and he hired lawyers, and they fought the good battle, and based on the lack of evidence thereof, they were battling, and basically the court fees all totaled around $300,000, and had he won the case, which he didn't, he would have ended up ahead $200,000. It would have made much more sense for them to sit down with the other side and say, listen, maybe we could work out some kind of settlement, because again, you're not supposed to give people bad advice, and clearly this was an example of giving somebody bad advice. Now, people come to you and they ask you to represent them. And we're going to assume they have a valid case, they're justified halachically, legally, morally, on all levels. Yes?
Is the thing only for Jewish people or for Zionists?
No, it's even for a non-Jew. If you know a non-Jew comes to you for to represent him, and you know that he's wrong, and you help him win money, so your I believe naive, the Talmud tells us a non-Jew is not allowed to eat Eber Min HaChai. Eber Min HaChai is an animal which was which a limb was removed from the animal prior to the death of the animal. Okay, you chopped off a leg from a live goat and you roasted it up, so it's forbidden for a non-Jew to eat that. So if you give it to him, the Gemara tells us you're overleaf either. So it would be applied to anything that a non-Jew is not allowed to steal. Right? So if you enable a non-Jew to steal by representing him in court, you're also overleaf neither the citizenship. Okay.
Again, for another attorney, go to another attorney.
Okay, so that's a big discussion. Let's say he could find another attorney. So, although that is an argument, but as you know, in Judaism, the answer is usually yes, no, and maybe. But there's many, many authorities that are of the opinion that even though he could find somebody else who will do it for you, for him, but you can't be the one to provide that. If there's a big discussion by ribis, by interest, that you're not, that if you borrow money on interest, besides the actual prohibition, you're also transgressing lifnei iver, because you're enabling the lender to lend with interest. So he said, I'll lend the money to somebody else. It doesn't make a difference. You are, in fact, the one who's causing him to transgress. Okay, so it's a big discussion. We're going to assume, generally speaking, it's not in your position. And even if technically you're not oyver lifnei iver, even those poskim that are of opinion it's not lifnei iver, there's a separate prohibition, a rabbinic prohibition, called misayeya, that you're helping somebody do an avera, that's asur midrabbanan, and anyways, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Now, the person comes to you, and there's a good chance, you know, nothing is guaranteed, and there are no guarantees in life, but there's a good chance that he will prevail, and then it's good sound advice, you should represent him, and it's the morally halachic correct thing to do. However, we know as believing Jews, there is an obligation for us to primarily go to Beis Din where possible. If there is a Beis Din that has jurisdiction over such matters, assuming that it is appropriate, you know, the exact cases when a person is not obligated to go to Beis Din, there are certain exceptions. We're not going through that right now. But generally speaking, it is the correct and halachically acceptable method to attempt to convince the client to go to Beis Din. Now, if he's the defendant and the other person is suing him in court, he doesn't really have the obligation, as it were, to say, well, I only want to go to Bezdin, because the other person is not interested in Bezdin. The other person says, I'm taking you to court. So you don't have to roll over and play dead. You're allowed to defend yourself in court. However, that being said, both in the cases when you're permitted to go directly to court, whether you're the plaintiff or the defendant, there is a, shall I say, an advisable route to first send at least one letter from the Bezdin saying that you are interested, rather than adjudicating the dispute in court, you'd rather go to a Bezdin. What's the reason? What's the necessity for that? The concept is as follows. In halacha, Bezdin, any damage that you do to this other person or claims that you have, which you're defending, you're entitled to based to the full letter of the law, to the first full extent of the law. However, like we mentioned before, damages which are caused or losses which you just caused the other person to have, that's difficult to extract from the other party. Included in causing damage, which would not be considered direct damage, is your court fees, your lawyer's fees. All those fees are considered causative damage, and therefore if I caused you a loss because you had to defend your case and you had to hire lawyers, that's too bad, you know. Bezdin can't make you pay that, and the court can't make you pay that. However, halachically, even if the court would obligate me, you would not be entitled to collect it. In other words, let's say the court would say that this side prevails, and they're entitled not only for their claim, but in addition they're entitled to all court fees and lawyer's fees, but halacha, you would not be entitled to collect it unless the Bezdin gave you permission to pursue it in court. Concept being, I'll call on you in a moment, the concept being, because since really he should be going to Bezdin, and the other party refused to go to Bezdin, so what the Bezdin does is they say, let the courts act on behalf of Bezdin to force the person to do what he's supposed to be doing. And in those situations, you'd then be able to collect your court fees and your lawyer's fees. Halachically, it would be permissible to collect them from court through Bezdin. And therefore, it's a good advice to at least go through the, you know, like they say, to shuckle, to bend in the direction of Bezdin. And if Bezdin then will give you permission to pursue your case in court, whether as the defendant or the plaintiff, you'd then be entitled to court fees. Yes?
What is the correct thing to, let's say you need to get injunctive relief to prevent someone you mentioned earlier from, let's say, wiping out, you know, a corporation, wiping out the accounts?
Okay.
Is there an issue involved with going to the Arcos in the first instance?
Okay.
To try and get injunctive relief pending going to Bezdin?
Absolutely. Okay. So let me answer the question. Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes in the Tshuva very clearly that getting a injunction, a court injunction to prevent a person from removing the assets or getting rid of the assets, that is permissible, it would seem, and it's not considered going through the court system in a prohibited fashion. In addition, the Bezdin could issue what's called an ikol, which is the equivalent of an injunction, but, you know, my friends, I tell them, in addition to getting the injunction from Bezdin, it is advisable, until pending the court case, to get an injunction against the property or the assets, so that it shouldn't be wiped out, and then we're going to be fighting over nothing. Okay? Now, the Rambam, which we mentioned before, Maimonides, says the reason that the Mishnah discourages one to behave like a lawyer is because they have a tendency, don't blame them, but they have a tendency to stretch the truth, to encourage their clients to obfuscate the facts. That means, you know, when a person takes the stand, he has to say the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So, you know, if you leave out certain details of the events as they were, it's very common for the judge to have a mistaken understanding of what actually transpired. And therefore, we discourage people from behaving like lawyers. So when we say this, behaving like lawyers means that the lawyer will encourage their client to hide facts, to distort facts, to change facts on various levels, white lies, pink lies, purple lies, as the case may be. He says, and even if it's the case, the Rambam goes very far out with this, and you have to understand what he's saying, but he says that even if it's the case that by leaving out these facts, the truth will not be served, which means you know you're right, not only because, you know, everybody knows they're right, but the empirical truth is that you are really in the right. And if you're going to reveal the facts, you're going to incriminate yourself. He says, Hashem, God loves the truth, and you have to be the truth, you have to say the truth, and even in the event that it's going to cause you to lose, that's the way it has to be. Now, my personal opinion, which I'm scared to stick out my neck too far because Rabbi Cohen may slice it off, but in the event that there are facts which might be taken out of context, often statements are made in a context. And the way, in the context in which the statement was made, it had one meaning. But if it's taken out of context, it has a completely different meaning. So in those situations, the way I feel, it would be permissible to skip certain facts as they were. In other words, not to mention certain comments which were made, because they were taken out of context. And if they're going to be presented to the judges, it might incriminate the party in an erroneous fashion, and judges might not understand what was really intended to be said. But that, again, requires a very, very, you have to be very sensitive to know when yes and when not. When you get to Beis Din, or prior to coming to Beis Din, it's important to know, Rabbi Cohen mentioned, there's the arbitration agreement, the Shtar Beirin. Now, this arbitration agreement often takes, if the people come into Beis Din without having seen the arbitration agreement and the scope of the arbitration agreement, it often could take an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, where the litigants and their representatives are busy negotiating what should be included in the arbitration agreement, what should not be included in the arbitration agreement, and it could go ad infinitum. They could be arguing about yeah, no, yes, no, a whole day. So it is appropriate and it's advisable to streamline the process. If you're going to Beis Din, when you're going to Beis Din, call up the Beis Din and say, please send me a copy of the arbitration agreement so that I could take a look at it and decide together with my client what we are going to Beis Din to arbitrate and what we are not going to Beis Din to arbitrate. And you'll submit it to the Beis Din, your amended copy, and the Beis Din will then submit it to the other side. And it will go back and forth until all parties agree that this is what we're coming to Beis Din for. Because otherwise, there's much, much, much heartache and waste of time and people's, you know, I hate to say the expression, time is money. People's lives, I mean, especially if you're a lawyer, but people's time is worth something. And it's very, very kedai. It makes a lot of sense that the arbitration agreement should be made up to snuff. Now, you have to decide a number of issues. The first thing is, are the litigants going to be signing personally, or are they only signing on behalf of a corporation, or both? I mean, sometimes I have a claim against this particular party, not his corporation. Sometimes I have a claim against the corporation. Sometimes I have a claim against the corporation and him as the CEO of the corporation. So it has to be decided, is the person going to be signing personally? Is he going to be signing on behalf of the corporation? It has to be decided, look at the convention, are we going for strict din? Are we going for pshara? Are we going for pshara karvla din? Or, you know, what are the rulings? What, based on what? And you also have to understand, although the word pshara means settlement, not every Beis Din, their halachic approach to a pshara is the same. You know, no, we do not cut the baby in half, we hope. But there's different approaches, what's included in pshara, what's not included in pshara, and you want to make sure that you're comfortable with the approach that this Beis Din has to a settlement. Finally, it's also important to know that what are the claims being addressed? So we're addressing the claims that Reuven has against Shimon, but what about the claims that Shimon has against Reuven? There are counterclaims, and which claims are going to be, you know, Beis Din can't just sit down and say, okay, you're going to have a fight? Okay, let's hear what you have to say. We're going to sign all fights. And you say, well, I didn't know. I thought you were coming to me about a certain stock deal. I didn't realize that he broke your window and he smashed into your car. It's beyond the scope of today's discussion. So it has to be very well defined in the arbitration agreement to what degree we are going to be and what's included, what's fair game. Now, when you get there, although it is incumbent upon the Beis Din to make sure this happens, but like and the Kohen mentioned, not all but they did not create it equal, it would behoove you, as you're representing your client, to make sure that the party from the other side, who's signing on the arbitration agreement, has legal authority to do so. Because sometimes it happens, the person comes in, he signs the arbitration agreement, they sit in Beis Din for two or three sessions, and after all the argumentation is finished, the guy said, yeah, but I couldn't really represent my corporation, I'm just a small fry in the corporation, I had no legal representation, I had no authority to do so. So you gotta make sure that the person who's representing the party is indeed the person who's able to sign the legal documents. Now, the next point which sometimes strikes lawyers when they come into Beis Din is the decorum that goes on in Beis Din. Now, in court, if a lawyer or a party brings up topics which seem to be far afield, it's not really what the case is about. And the person who's presenting his case feels that somehow there is a thread which will somehow tie in to the case at hand. So the lawyer from the other side, correctly so in court, would say, I object, Your Honor, he's going into Neverland. Or ultimately he's saying, you know, he'll start asking questions, he's going on a fishing expedition, as the case may be, things which are not relevant to the matters at hand. In Beis Din, we give a lot of leeway. And to allow the parties to be somewhat verbose. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, we want, like the Kohen mentioned, we want the parties to some degree represent what transpired in their own words. A case could be very well sanitized after it goes through the washing machine of legal representation. So we want the parties to come and present their case on their own, in their own words, and if we are going to inhibit them from presenting the case as they see it, they are going to be intimidated, they're going to perhaps not say what they should be saying for their benefit, and perhaps they may incriminate themselves by saying exactly what actually transpired. So the Beis Din wants to hear, in the words of the litigants, their own thing. So that sometimes requires what we call Bubba Mises, grandmother stories about what transpired in the story. So although it may be not so such decorum, and sometimes the stories are somewhat humorous, and sometimes they're aggravating, nonetheless, the Beis Din does, to a degree, encourage such discussions. Now, you have to know that the legal representation on the other side, the Beis Din should not allow them to interrupt the parties from presenting their story. If they have any questions, they could wait, mark it down on a piece of paper, and when it will come their turn, they could respond to the things which were stated or asserted. To interrupt, it actually disturbs the Dayanim. The Dayanim are not able to hear the story in its entirety. Almost every single time, the people who object to the words of the other party, the person's about to incriminate himself, and the other party goes and interrupts and prevents him from incriminating himself. So we want very much to allow the people the chance to give enough rope to hang themselves. Now, when it's your turn to respond, you're not entitled to ask the other party pointed questions. You said this, I could prove to you that it's not true, all of this. You do not address the other party, you address the Beis Din. And you could present to the Beis Din your version of the facts. You could present the Beis Din your proofs to the, you assert what you believe is the facts, and you present your proofs to the facts as you see them. And if you have questions which you feel must be submitted to the other side, or to the other party, you present them to the Beis Din. The Beis Din will decide whether they feel it's appropriate, and they will then submit the questions to the Beis Din, to the other side. Otherwise, it becomes completely out of hand, and it's totally inappropriate. Now, having said that we do want genuine self-representation and of the story, it is advisable and it's necessary that prior to coming to Beis Din, the legal representation should sit down together with his client and discuss the facts and to go through the story as he's going to present it. Not because you want to teach him, no, don't say that because that's a lot, because then you're going to lose. Don't. You should say this because then you'll win. You can't do that. That's, we said, that's forbidden. But you have to start helping him distinguish between that which is relevant and that which is totally irrelevant. Yes, we want to hear the whole story as much as is necessary. But we had a person who came into Beis Din for 2.5 hours. He presented a story. Was going on and on and on about how he hired the guy because he was really his shadchan and it was his wife's shadchan and they were such good friends and going back and they had such a good relationship for so many years. Totally irrelevant to the matter at hand. But he went on for 2.5 hours.
Why did you leave him to do that?
So we didn't know. We
2.5 hours?
We stopped him like 4 times in the middle and said, is this really relevant? Yeah, I'm up to the point. And every time, he didn't get up to the point. When he finished his presentation for 2.5 hours, he says, now I have a few notes here I'd like to read you. And what he did for the next 30 minutes, he reread all of his arguments, at least this time. This is what he should have read the first time. His halachic arguments, he had concisely put them on a piece of paper, which was 30 minutes. The rest of it was total, you know, popcorn. But we didn't really have a choice based on the situation. When you go to a lawyer, the lawyer should be able and willing to distinguish between what's necessary, what's not necessary, and then when the person will present his case, it will be concise. There's a part, Shlomo HaMelech said, "B'chol atzav yehi musar," which means with all brevity, there's what to be gained. The more, if there's too much fluff, then it's very hard to see the trees for the forest. There's just too much going on. You have to be able, okay, now. Your job in the Beis Din would be as follows. When you come into Beis Din, although, thank God, hopefully the Dayanim are very familiar with the laws of Shulchan Aruch and they're very familiar with the general goings-on of reading documents and the relevant statutes, which, you know, understanding the business involved. However, very often, the Beis Din needs the lawyers to present to them what are, chapter and verse, the statutes which are relevant to this case. Very well be that there's, you know, the legislature, depending if we're dealing with a federal, a state law, or a federal law, and what are the statutes on, you know, on today? You know, we had a case regarding rent control, and the statutes in New Jersey have been updated 2 or 3 times. So what are the latest statutes? And in addition, not only what are the statutes involved, chapter and verse, but the actual wording thereof, it's also very important for them to bring in precedent and how judges and courts have ruled on the matter. And in addition, what is usually done in these situations? Now the reason for this is not because the Shulchan Aruch will roll over and play dead in front of Dina de Malchusa. Dina de Malchusa does play a role in halacha. The laws of the land play a role in civil matters to a degree. You know, obviously in criminal matters, that's where we go. But in civil matters, they have a certain degree of relevance, but it's not the whole auction code. It's very important for the Beis Din to know exactly what is the Dina de Malchusa, what is the law. And based on what the law is, the Beis Din will take that into consideration when they issue their ruling. What's even more important is if we're able to establish what's called the minhag hamokim. What is the usual and customary outcome or to such a situation? You know, you brought up before, what's going to be, people are uncomfortable, they go into court, or they go into Beis Din, as the case may be, and they don't know the outcome is going to be. Law is what, when they talk about civil law, it's like, you know, person engage in business based on the assumption that they know what any given judge will rule on this matter. So if there's an established custom as to what is usually and customarily done in such a situation, so then if you're able to prove that to the Beis Din, that will have a big impact upon the outcome of the Din Torah. Now, BTW, parenthetically, there will often be documents which are going to be brought and presented in Beis Din. And these documents although they may be legally standing, have complete legal standing on all levels, when it comes to halacha, it is really, really good advice before the fight came about. When they first, you know, they're still in the honeymoon, the two parties, and they didn't sign on the dotted line yet, they should really have the document looked over by a halachic authority, a dayan, who's familiar. Because, for example, very often people give money on investments, and they have with guaranteed, with the principal is guaranteed. This they're promising returns, and the principal is guaranteed. So this runs into problems of ribis, interest, which is prohibited. Or ultimately, there could be problems. Let's say you have a remedy in a document, whether it's a purchase or whether it's a non-compete, whatever the remedy is. If that remedy is not crafted with halachic criteria, so then you're going to end up in a situation where legally the document is of substance, but halachically it's not of substance. So you better make sure, prior to going into the deal, that before the party signed, before the ink is signed, to make sure that it's been eyeballed by a dayan who could tell you that this document will stand up in Bezdin or won't stand up in Bezdin, because otherwise you're simply not doing your client any favor by closing your eyes to that issue. Sometimes we have in Bezdin, there's the dinfer is going on, and in the middle there's a lawyer there, and he says, "If I want to, I can take this to court." In the middle of the dinfer, says, "What's up? You're eons too late, because first of all, if we're dealing with two religious Jews, you have to go to Bezdin. You can't just say, I'm going to go to court, number one. Number two, unfortunately, you know, sometimes the threats are, I'm going to take you to court and you're going to rot in jail, because not only were you civilly, you were criminally, I'm sorry, you can't do that. It's, you know, but besides which, once you sign that piece of paper, you're bound. You know, the arbitration agreement binds you to the ruling of this Bezdin. Now, let's say that the entire, yes?
Have a second set of eyes on the document,
yes,
beforehand.
Yes.
Speak about the response from my clients that they have to now pay for two sets of counsel. You know, if it's a two-page document that has it in a non-compete, it's not a big deal. But if I have a 112-page operating agreement for a $100 million deal between firm people, and I say, well, they have to have now another set of religious
okay.
perspective on it, how do you deal with that?
Okay, so I'm going to answer your question to the best of my ability. And that means like this. There are, you said, they're religious people. I'm assuming that means they're the Orthodox persuasion, Orthodox Jewish persuasion. Now, that being the case, you really have to explain to them that halacha frowns greatly on them going to court. And thereby, they're going to be obligated, they're going to be caught just by the Sefer Torah that they read from every Sabbath, right? They're going to be caught, they're going to be obligated halachically to bring this dispute into Bezdin first. The Shulchan Aruch, which they claim to follow, says that a person who goes to court, civil court, instead of going to halachic, without first trying to go to Bezdin, is a macharif, a megarif, a megadif, a meremiyavit, or a smoysha, or a benolam, he's not a good guy. Okay? So if they understand that, and they really believe that, and they're car-carrying members of whichever Orthodox Jewish organization we're talking about, so then they have to understand that even if it's going to cost them 120 pages, Dayan don't charge like lawyers, even though perhaps they should, but they don't. They asked me, they should, but they don't. So, but they have to understand they're risking millions of dollars. If it's millions of dollars, they're risking millions of dollars if the document doesn't stand the halachic test. Okay? Now, maybe you'll tell me, you know, they have a few different cards. They keep them in different pockets, and depending on where they're going, they're going to pull out, okay, I won't go there to Shulim, or I'll go to, you know, but I'm saying, but that ultimately there has to be the response on some level, okay? I hope I did justice to your question. At the end of the Din Torah, after you've presented your case, sometimes, often, you feel you need more time to think about it. So you could request from the Bezdin, before you issue your ruling, please give me time. We're going to look for additional evidence. That's something you walk out of Bezdin and you feel, okay, the Bezdin doesn't appreciate our position. So you go out, before you leave, you say, we'd like another sitting, we'd like another session, please give us 2 weeks to prepare, or whatever you feel is necessary, and you can go back, you're entitled, the Bezdin usually will accommodate. After the Din Torah, let's assume like we all love to know, all hope and pray, that we are victorious and we win the din Torah. Please get your ruling ratified by the judge, because he said, ultimately in America, these United States, we are the only jurisdiction we have is based on the arbitration agreement, and the laws of arbitration require that the arbitration ruling is ratified by a judge after the ruling within a certain statute of limitations. I think in New York it's a year, I don't know exactly what it is. If you don't get it ratified by the judge, and for some reason, let's say the payments, let's say there's a payment schedule, and that payment schedule extends multiple years. So the first year, the guy's paying like a tatala. He's paying like a nice little boy, and he's paying what he's supposed to be paying every month on schedule. And at the end of the year, he starts paying. He's like, what's going on? He says, I don't have the money. Blah, blah, blah. And you want to go to court? No, now it's too late. You never ratified your arbitration ruling. So don't lose your the statute of limitation. It's not good advice. In the event, it shouldn't happen, but sometimes happens. Even the best of lawyers with the best of cases. Yes?
Is there an Isser Arkais for going to confirm an award?
No.
So you can do that without getting a hector to go to court?
Yeah, but you have to get, technically speaking, you're going to have to get a copy of the arbitration agreement. You're going to have to get all the paperwork. Something has to be translated. If the ruling's in Hebrew, it's going to have to be. You're going to need the assistance of the Beis Din to do it, but technically speaking, you don't need that. You have the ruling, and you could go to court to have it confirmed.
You said something before about the corporation. You have to have the shtarbrunner, if it's a corporate obligation or claim against the corporation, that the ruling is only going to be against the corporation, or can the Beis Din rule against an individual even though it's only a corporate obligation?
The answer to that question is, what did the arbitration agreement say from the onset? If it said clearly that we're having a corporate dispute, so then the Beis Din cannot rule against the individual. If it doesn't say anything,
even though it's a corporate obligation, they can rule that the individual is liable?
Again, we have to know what the guy signed. Theoretically speaking, if I run a corporation and it's a sham, and you know,
it's not a sham corporation.
It's a genuine corporation, right. And the person is the. I have a corporation, but I personally stole the money, so I'm personally responsible. The corporation is running a business, and me as an individual in that corporation, I personally stole the money. So the Beis Din might hold the corporation and the individual
responsible.
The corporation
doesn't protect you if you stole the money. It's a question.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly what I'm saying.
Civil obligation. Can the Beis Din ignore the corporate veil, if you want to call it?
They could.
Even though you didn't agree to it.
No, not if you didn't. If you didn't sign on it as a personal. If you didn't sign personally, it has to be clear in the arbitration agreement whether it's personally or corporate. Yes.
The carte blanche that you have to go to court to confirm, does that entail everything? Like if the Beis Din gives you injunctive relief and says this has to happen, and that person doesn't follow the court's ruling, the remedy in court is to move for contempt, which could involve jail time.
Right. So what I would suggest at that point, no, I can't give you a carte blanche, certainly not here. But I'm telling you is, at the time, when it will be relevant, if it's relevant, you'll have to ask the presiding Beis Din their particular opinion on that matter. We're not going on record. Yeah, Rabbi Gutman said the other party is causing problems, just take him to court, throw him in jail, throw away the key. We're not going there. The last point I just want to bring up, that sometimes it happens even with the best of cases and with the most justified positions and the best lawyers, sometimes the Beis Din does not see it your way. They simply don't see it your way, for whatever reason. So possibly you didn't see it straight, and possibly the Chafetz Chaim himself speaks about such a situation where you know that for whatever reason the Beis Din missed it. They didn't understand, they didn't believe you, the hell you were a liar, when in reality you were telling the truth. But such things happen. An impression is an impression. In those cases, the Chafetz Chaim says that you have to realize ki hamishpat elokim, who ultimately, God is the ultimate judge, and for whatever reason, this was his vehicle through which he brought about what he felt was the outcome that was in your best interest. The Talmud tells us if a person goes to court, goes to Beis Din, and he loses, and they take his shirt in Beis Din, he should sing a song. So it's not talking about he should sing a song only if he's right, if he was wrong. But even if he's right, and he lost the case, he should sing a song, because this is Hashem's way of perhaps evening some type of score that you needed to be evened. And thank you.